Good evening. You can open your Bibles to the book of Hosea. And I just have to say this, that this afternoon at the Gibson's house, that Elizabeth was baptized today. And so we rejoice and we praise God to see something like that happen. It's always such exciting news. And speaking of being redeemed and following God, God's love is something that I think all of us, and I know I'm speaking for myself, need to learn how to appreciate to its fullest extent. I don't know if you've ever heard Mark Wade say a prayer or make some kind of public comment, and the way that he talks about God's love, for me, just makes me wish that I had more of that appreciation that he has. There's certain people that will talk about the love of God in this very excited kind of way where they just love to talk about the love of God. And I don't know if you've ever heard people like that and felt like you couldn't really relate to that or you couldn't really understand why they were getting as excited or as emotional as they seemed to. But depending on where we are on this spectrum of appreciating the love of God, surely all of us could say that we could grow in that. How do we grow in our appreciation for what God has done for us? And by the way, when you think about children who have been loved just lavishly by their parents, and then the kids don't have any kind of appreciation for that, we have a word for that, and it's called spoiled. Have you ever been frustrated with somebody who was physically spoiled, like somebody who had everything given, but they just turned out to be jerks? I would suggest that if we ever point the finger at people like that, that could be us spiritually. If God's love and his grace hasn't transformed us and hasn't created a new kind of person. Well, what books of the Bible show God's love? All of them do. But maybe in one of the most vivid ways is the book of Hosea. And on Sunday nights for some time, we had been going through the minor prophets. I put a pause on that for a little bit, but I just couldn't pull myself away from doing the book of Hosea. I've never taught it before. It's a book that I've really wanted to talk about. And so we're going to look at Hosea 1 through 3 today, and then probably consecutively on Sunday nights, we'll be looking at this book, probably for 4 or 5 or maybe 6 sermons is how we'll approach this. But just like we did before, these lessons on the minor prophets, we're not talking about every detail. We're covering more chapters at a time for these. And so we're just trying to get a taste of some books that maybe have been more neglected. So let's go ahead and start out by reading the first verse of Hosea to introduce this book for us. So Hosea 1:1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, that's in the south, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, that's in the north. Notice just a couple things right away about the time period of when this book is taking place. If you were to look at all the names of those kings, none of us are going to memorize those kings right off the bat, but here's the point of this. If you were to know the historical context of this, this takes place during the time of 2 Kings chapters 14 through 20. That's the time period that Hosea is a prophet. If you wanted the years, that's 750 to 710 BC. You notice, though, that in the first verse, you have the kings. Remember, the nation of Israel split into two, into the north and the south. The kings of the south are mentioned, but I'm not really going to spend much time talking about them because the king, Hosea is more so addressing the north than he is the south. He's going to say some things about the south in the book, but he's mainly addressing the north. So the king of the north was Jeroboam. That's Jeroboam the second, by the way. Do you remember the first king of the north was Jeroboam the first? Do you remember what his sin was? He introduced the golden calves for worship. And kind of set the tone for all the kings in the northern kingdom. And so it would make you wonder, why would somebody ever say, well, I want my kid to be Jeroboam the second? Like, that would be today saying, I want my kid to be named Hitler. None of us would do that. And so this man, Jeroboam, what was life like under this man's reign as king? Well, we know from 2 Kings that the reign of this man was one that brought great prosperity to the nation. The borders were expanded during this time period, and so the nation was very, very wealthy. You think about some of the prophets that were prophesying during the same time period. In the north, you also had Amos and Jonah. Do you remember when we covered the book of Amos a couple months ago? Do you remember how hard-hitting the book of Amos was? It was like every paragraph in that book was just slapping us in the face. At the same time period, you have Hosea, who's also preaching to the same people, and his tone is going to be very different. We'll talk more about that as we go through this, but think about what we know about Hosea himself. His name, Hosea, means to save or to rescue. That's, by the way, the meaning of the same name of Joshua and of Jesus. And it's ironic because this man, his name means to save. Well, who does he save in this book? He saves his wife, Gomer, and we're going to see that in these three chapters. We also know that his father was Beeri. We don't know anything about that guy. We don't know much about Hosea other than what we read about in these first three chapters, really, in this book. All right, so those are just some things about Hosea himself. Think about the message and the outline of the book, though. What is the book of Hosea about? What's the message of it? I think you can remember it with two words, and the first one is harlotry. About 13 times in the book, you're going to see the words harlotry or whoredom in some translations. And the reason for that is because the nation is pictured as this wife that's cheating on her husband. And so you see the failure of the nation, but then you also see the love of God for this woman who's continually cheated on him. In the New Testament, who is the apostle of love? It's John. Some people have said that Hosea is the Old Testament apostle of love. He's the prophet of love because of how much he talks about it. So even though the nation of Israel has cheated on God, God is pleading with these people to still return to him. We'll see that as we go through this book. But here's maybe some outlines of the book. The first three chapters show you the personal life of Hosea and his marriage to Gomer. That's what we're looking at tonight. So it's a personal story. And then chapters 4 through 14 go to the national scope, where it's the nation of Israel and how they kind of parallel the relationship that Hosea had with Gomer. That's one way that you can outline the book. Here's another way. In the first three chapters, you have Hosea's marriage. And then chapters 4 through 14, you have the messages or selected sermons that Hosea preached. So before he preached, he first had to experience this marriage. So you got marriage and message. Those are a couple different ways that you can remember that. Okay, those are things that we'll remind ourselves of as we go through this series. But what we're looking at tonight, the first three chapters, can be outlined like this. Chapter 1, verses 2 through 9, you're going to see Hosea and Gomer. And then there's going to be this middle section where it's God and Israel and how Hosea and Gomer parallel that relationship. And then chapter 3 is one of the shortest chapters of the Bible. And we're going to go back to Hosea and Gomer, and all these parallels are going to be put together. So that's what we're going to be looking at tonight. So let's go ahead and start with this first section, Hosea chapter 1, verses 2 through 9. And this is where we're going to see Hosea's marriage to Gomer. So Hosea chapter 1, verses 2 through 9. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom, and have children of whoredom, for the land commits a great whoredom by forsaking the Lord." So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said to him, "Call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." She conceived again and bore a daughter. And the Lord said to him, "Call her name No Mercy, for I will have no mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by the bow or by the sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen." When she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, "Call his name not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God." You can't not read what this is saying here and walk away thinking that God would never command us to do something hard. You see what God is commanding Hosea to do? Go marry a woman of whoredom. go marry a woman of harlotry. Now, there's debates about this. Does this mean that she was a harlot before they got married? That she was sexually defiled before they got married? Or does this mean that she became a harlot after they got married? Well, if the parallel is that Gomer is representing the nation of Israel committed idolatry even in the land of Egypt. And so it would make sense that she would have been a woman that was defiled in different kinds of ways before he even married her, which means that he's kind of rescuing her out of that. But he's told right at the beginning here that she's going to continue this lifestyle. Did you notice, though, how prompt Hosea's obedience is to this instruction? Just follow the verbs in verse 2. God says, go, take, have children. Did you see what Hosea did in verse 3? He went, he took, and she conceived. Are there hard things that God has commanded you to do? Are there things that seem really challenging, sins that you don't want to cut out of your life because they mean too much to you? Or maybe relationships that need to be cut out of your life because they mean too much to you. And you've got Hosea here who's told, before he even does it, you're going to marry a woman that's going to break your heart. And immediately he goes, he takes, and he has children. What is it that you're putting off right now? What you think about the children that Hosea and Gomer have with each other. I want to point something out in this text that's really important to notice. In verse 3, the first child, notice that it says that she conceived and bore him a son. Who's the him? That's Hosea. Skip down to verse 6. She conceived again and bore a daughter. It doesn't say that she bore him a daughter. Skip down to verse 8. When she had weaned no mercy, she conceived and bore a son. Do you see the difference between those two verses and the first one? The implication here is that the first child was Hosea's child. The second two, the daughter and the second son, those two were not actually his children. Can you imagine being Hosea? And you marry this woman, the first kid is yours, it seems like it's starting off on the right track, and then you're starting to wonder, these second and third kids, are they really even my kids? Can you imagine that? Well, notice the names of the children. God is the one that's giving the names of these children. The first one is Jezreel, which means God scatters or God sows. Well, how do you make sense of those two definitions? How do you sow seed in the ancient world? By scattering it, right? So there's going to be a play on word with that name, if I remember to bring it up later in the lesson. But God is saying here that your guys are going to be exiled. The Assyrians are going to go ahead and do that. But did you notice the reason for the judgment? For Jehu. The bloodshed of Jehu. And if anybody knows their Old Testament history, you know that that's a puzzling statement. Because God told Jehu to kill the house of Ahab. And he did it. And then here this verse says that he's going to be judged for doing what God told him to do. So how do we make sense of that? We don't have time to get into all of this because this is a separate sermon in itself. But the bottom line is that Jehu didn't fully obey God in everything. And he didn't obey God from the right heart. So you can do what God has asked you to do, but do it from the wrong motive. And God will still judge you for it. So that's one thing to say about that. All right, here's the second child. Lo Ruhamah. There's one time I went paintballing with Barry Kircheville, and I shot him in the forehead when we were paintballing. And one of the things that we kept yelling out to each other is, Lo Ruhamah! I guess that's something that preachers do when they play paintball, which probably doesn't happen very often. But when you see the word lo, that means no. Lo means no. The word Ruhamah means mercy. So here's this child named No Mercy. Okay, Jeffrey and Andrea just had a child last week. Do you think when they held Isabella for the first time, they went, oh, we just got to change the name to No Mercy. I mean, what a sad name to give a child. The first name means they're going to be scattered. They're going to be taken away from their homeland. The second name stings a little bit more because it's saying that even though you guys are going to be scattered, something worse is going to happen because God is going to retract his mercy from you guys. He's not going to show you compassion anymore because you've persisted in your sin. Notice the third one, by the way, Lo Ami, which means not my people. These are not my people. This is like God saying, I am divorcing the nation of Israel. by naming this kid. But can you imagine, by the way, living in this time period, and Hosea and Gomer are married, everybody knows because it's in this village or this city, and people kind of know each other back then. And so they have one kid, and then this is the name of the first kid, the second kid, and people are like, well, you know, you're picking some strange names for your children. What's up with that? What do you think Hosea would say to the people? Well, God told me to name the kids these names because this is what's going to happen to us. Now, at this point, there's a couple reflections that we need to make from this book. The first one is this. Why would God have Hosea go through this? Why would God ask Hosea to marry a woman that he knew was going to do this to him? Here's what God is doing with Hosea. Before Hosea starts preaching to the people, his heart first has to be broken like God's heart has been. Have you ever gone through something really, really, really hard? And you've asked the question, what's going on? What's the purpose to all of this? Here's what's going on with Hosea. He's being prepared to preach by going through this experience and experiencing the same heart that God has. You might be going through something really hard right now. Do you know what it could be doing in your life? Preparing you to help people in ways that you never would have imagined. Here's a second reflection, though. Our relationship with God is pictured as a marriage. Now, it's pictured as a bad marriage. It's pictured as a marriage, though. For whoever's married in this room, you all know that the most important human relationship you have is your relationship to your spouse. Now, if our relationship with God is pictured as a marriage, would you say that your relationship with Christ has been your priority? Or have other things started to creep into your heart where you're starting to cheat on God by putting things above him? Those are just a couple things to think about that. All right, here's this middle section, though. When people talk about the first three chapters of Hosea, the verses we just looked at are commonly talked about, and then chapter three is commonly talked about. This middle section is the section that I think is oftentimes more neglected than the other two. So look what God is going to do and how this pictures the nation of Israel, what we've read. So look at chapter 1, verses 10 through chapter 2, verse 1. God is going to restore the people even though they've broken his heart. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea. That's fulfilling the promise to Abraham in Genesis 12, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head, that would be the Messiah, and they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Say to your brothers, you are my people, and to your sisters, you have received mercy. You can probably see already the reversal of everything we just read about. You've got the name of these three children, and instead of not being God's people, they will be God's people. Instead of not having mercy, they will receive mercy. Everything's going to be reversed in this. There's going to be a coming out of the exile here. Does this sound familiar, though, to you, what we just read? Do you know that there's a New Testament passage that quotes this and applies it to the Christian? 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 10. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Do you realize that all of us have cheated on God? All of us have broken his heart. All of us have grieved the Holy Spirit. And because of that, once we were not a people. Once we had no mercy in our life. And then God took us out of the greatest exile anybody could ever experience, which is separation from God. He took us out of that exile, and he made us his treasured possession. Now, this is going to be fleshed out more as we go through this. Look at how God is going to try to bring them back. Notice Hosea chapter 2, verses 2 through 5. He's going to try to get the people to be warned about what happens if they don't repent. Hosea chapter 2, verses 2 through 5. Plead with your mother, plead. For she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. That she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and make her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and make her like a parched land, and kill her with thirst. Upon her children also I will have no mercy, because they are children of whoredom. For their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Was anybody confused at verse 2? Plead with your mother. What does that mean? I think we're getting this imagery of the nation of Israel, and the children of Israel are encouraged to go to the leaders and go to everybody else and hold each other accountable and plead with these people and say, let's please put this idolatry away from us because we've been cheating on God. Did you notice in verse 5 how deceived Israel is? She thinks that all of the blessings that she has, her bread, her water, her wool, her flax, her oil, her drink, everything that she has is from these false lovers that she has. Can we ever do that same thing? Where we really feel like the best things that we have in our life have come because I'm just really smart. Because I made really good decisions. Or because I've figured things out for myself. Or because I have this thing in my life, and this is kind of like my genie lamp, and this thing makes everything nice for me. Here's what the Christian needs to be warned of in this. The good things that you have in your life, do you trace it back to the good giver who gave it to you? Or do you look at the things that you have and not give God credit for it? The truth is, every good thing we have comes from God. This woman thinks that all the good things she has come from her false lovers and not from God who was her true husband. And because of that, notice what God is going to do. In verses 3 and 4, he's going to strip her naked. You know what that would mean in that time period? The nation of Israel had ornate houses. Houses of paneling that we read about in the book of Hosea. And God is saying, all of this nice stuff that you think you've been given by these false gods, it's all going to be stripped away. You're going to be put to shame. And the land that was supposed to be a land flowing with milk and honey is going to be turned into utter wilderness. Because you have not been acknowledging that I'm the one who's been blessing you. So here's the warning. Again in verse 2, plead with your mother. Do we need to plead with each other? Do we ever hold each other accountable? Say, look, don't you realize that if you haven't been putting the Lord first, everything that you think you've been given by your false gods will be stripped away from you. Please consider serving the Lord. Do we ever have conversations like that with each other? That's what God is asking the nation to do here. But look at verses 6 through 13 and see further how God is going to discipline them to try to bring them back. Look at Hosea chapter 2, verses 6 through 13. Therefore, and notice all the times he says, I will here. Therefore, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her, so that she cannot find her paths. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them, and she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me than it is now. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore, I will take back my grain in its time, and my wine in its season, and I will take away my wool and my flax, which were to cover her nakedness. Now I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall rescue her out of my hand, and I will put an end to all her mirth, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her appointed feasts. And I will lay waste her vines and fig trees, of which she said, there are my wages, which my lovers have given me. I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall devour them. And I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she burned offerings to them, and adorned herself with her ring and jewelry, and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares the Lord. Do you see the love of God in these verses? In verses 6 and 7, God is going to hedge up his wife. Kind of like you would do with a farm animal. Like you kind of put this gate around it so that they can't go beyond the property that you own. God is saying, I'm going to hedge her up so that she can't find her paths. Well, what paths is he talking about? The paths to the false gods. Here's what God is saying. I'm going to make it so I'm going to cut off access that you have to your false gods. And then when that happens, you're finally going to get to a point where you're going to say, I want to go back to my first husband because that really was better. Did Jesus ever teach anything similar to this in the New Testament? If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Restrict access. If your right eye causes you to sin, cut it off. Here's what God is saying here. I'm going to cut off access to the false gods. And when that is restricted, you will get to a point where you want God all over again. But the way that he's going to do that is he's going to remove all of the physical blessings, the vine and the fig trees. All of these things are going to be taken away so that she hits rock bottom and then wants God. You might be looking at this and think, well, man, this nation must have just completely turned their back on God. Did you notice that in verse 11, God is going to remove the new moon feasts and the Sabbaths? Those are Old Testament Jewish practices, which means that they were still worshiping God. Then did you notice verse 13? They were also having feast days for the Baals. So they were actually like kind of worshiping God and worshiping the Baals. And God's saying the Baals are going to be taken away. And then you'll get to a point where you realize that God is the only thing that really matters. Try to think in your life. If all the things that you put above God were stripped away from you, would that not actually be a blessing? Would that not be a way to bring you back? In your life, does God need to do that? Are there things that you're so stubbornly holding on to that the only way your soul would be saved is if God ripped it from you so that you'd finally come to your senses? This is what God is doing with the nation. And notice that when she hits that point, what he's going to do in verses 14 through 20. This is one of the most shocking things that you'll read about in the Bible. Look at Hosea chapter 2, verses 14 through 20. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And there I will give her her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. That's, by the way, where Achan was stoned in the Old Testament. A place of judgment is now being turned into a place of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. Verse 16, and in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. And I will make that for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field and the birds of the heavens that were formerly used for judgment and the creeping things on the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. And I will make you lie down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice and in steadfast love and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. And you shall know the Lord. You notice how verse 14 starts? Therefore, I will. Now, if somebody was to just tell you the story of Hosea up to this point, that the nation of Israel has cheated on God, and then God was figuring out what to do, and somebody was to ask you, therefore, God will do what with them? You would think, therefore, God is going to just completely obliterate them. But instead, verse 14 says, therefore, I will allure her out to the wilderness. Why the wilderness? This is where the relationship first began. God brought them out of Egypt into the wilderness, and God is taking them back to this familiar territory. It's kind of like if a husband and wife went back to the place where their first kiss was, there would be some tenderness to that. God is taking them back to the place that the relationship started. And then he says, I'm going to speak tenderly to her. To this woman who has ripped out his heart, spit on it, and stepped all over it. Do you see the love of God? And God says that when I do this, the Baals that you used to worship are all going to be forgotten. You're not even going to remember the names of the Baals anymore. By the way, the word Baal just means my master. And so instead of calling God my master, if they ever called God Baal, that's typically for the false gods. But if they ever called God my master, that's more of like a business kind of relationship. And instead of calling God my Baal, they're going to call God my husband. Because the intimacy of the relationship has been restored. God is going to enter into a betrothal with them. If God had divorced the nation, he's going to do another ceremony with them. He's going to enter a new covenant with them. The beasts of the field will not harm them. This is going to be a covenant where there's going to be safety and peace. Do you see how much God puts up with? Do you see how patient God is with imperfect people? Notice, though, when this relationship is restored, that the blessings are going to return. Verses 21 through 23, And in that day I will answer, declares the Lord, I will answer the heavens and they will answer the earth. And the earth shall answer the grain, the wine, the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel. And I will sow her, that's where we get the play on word for Jezreel, I will sow her, this time in the good sense, for myself in the land, and I will have mercy on no mercy, and I will say, not my people, you are my people, and he shall say, you are my God. When you see the phrase, in that day, in the Old Testament, in that day is typically referring to the time of the New Covenant. In this day, God is going to sow the nation of Israel. Instead of scattering them away from their homeland, he's going to sow the seeds and they're going to grow up. Here's how God is picturing New Testament Christians. Like scattered seeds that grow. They bloom where they're planted. Do you remember in the New Testament, the book of James? James 1:1 says, to the 12 tribes in the dispersion. That's agricultural imagery. To be dispersed is what you do with seeds. God is saying, I'm going to sow you guys back into the land and you're going to sprout up. And you're going to be people that can pray to me and I will answer and I will bless you. I will bless these people. And what's the reason for that? So that the world can see the kindness and the mercy and the patience of God in our life. We've talked about this before, but if anybody has ever had the question, is God good? What's the answer? He's good because look what he's done in me. He's good because look what he's done in these Christians that I know. He's changed their life because of his steadfast love. Now, we get back then to Hosea and Gomer. We began with Hosea and Gomer, we end with Hosea and Gomer, and we're going to see this symbolic reunion that Hosea and Gomer literally go through to picture what God is going to do with the nation. By the way, some people have said Hosea chapter 3 is the greatest chapter of the Bible. I'm not sure that it is, but if somebody's going to say something like that, it's a pretty great chapter. Every chapter is great, but we're not going to have time to talk about everything in this. But let's go ahead and read Hosea chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lethich of barley. And I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. Here Hosea is told, go marry again a woman that you love. By the way, that indicates that Hosea loved her from the beginning, even though he was commanded to marry her. It's not like it was a cold marriage. He loved her. He says, go again. Marry this woman. Love this woman. But did you notice that in verse 1, this Gomer is pictured as the nation of Israel, and the nation of Israel loved, what was it that they loved? Cakes of raisin. Did you read that and go, what? They love cakes of raisin? I mean, Samantha makes some pretty good desserts. She's never made cakes of raisin. Maybe she needs to make those for me. What is the idea of that? Cakes of raisin is what would have been given to them when they would worship the false gods. Like when they would worship the false gods, part of the ceremony was the cakes of raisin. Why is Hosea pointing this out? Do you see how trite, do you see how trivial, do you see how pathetic it is that they're seeking after cakes over God? How pathetic. But when you think about some of the things that we put above God, are we not just as pathetic? We putting a sphere into a basket above God. That's called basketball. We put kicking a ball into a net above God. We put our cars, we put these things that have four rubber wheels that can be destroyed and will be destroyed one day, called a car, above God. We put so many stupid things above God. Cakes of raisins, that's all it is. Now, when Hosea is going to buy her back, do you see what happens in verse 3? That he's going to buy her back and he says, you dwell in my house for many days and you have no sexual relations with anybody. I think this is a period of probation for her to come and realize the depth of her sin and to mourn it. But this is also what God is doing with the nation of Israel. God is going to bring them out of the land, but he's not going to fully restore the relationship yet. They're going to go through the period of 400 years of silence where they can loathe their sin, and then Jesus will come and enter into relationship. Now, that's just some of the technical stuff about this. But notice the imagery of this. God tells Hosea, go again. When God spoke to Hosea, I wonder if Hosea had his palms of his hands buried into his eye sockets and he was just welling up with tears flowing down his face. And then God gives him another command that would be very hard, and he says, go again and love this woman. And for whatever reason, Gomer is on the auction block. She's gotten so low that she needs to sell herself into slavery. Can you imagine Hosea walking up to that auction block? And maybe he got there after one slave was sold, and then Gomer gets up there. And her hair is tangled, and she's just looking down, and she can't even look through her hair. And then the auctioneer says, okay, well, let's start this bid at 5 shekels. And somebody goes, I'll take her for 5 shekels. And then somebody else says, I'll take her for 10 shekels. And then here's Hosea, and he walks up. And everybody in the city knows the history of Hosea and Gomer. People look at him, and they wonder, what's he doing here? And he goes, I'll take her for 15 shekels. I'll give you some barley, too. Can you imagine, as soon as he said that, do you think Gomer recognized the voice? Do you think she maybe looked up a little bit and she went, how could he love me again? Is he buying me back to punish me? What's going on here? I've broken his heart, and here he is buying me back all over again. At what cost did it come to Hosea? You have to imagine that when Hosea bought her back, it came at a social price. Everybody would have looked at him with disgust and disdain that you weakling would go buy her back. Cost him financial money, 15 shekels. Cost him a lot of emotional pain. The Bible teaches that ultimately Jesus is the one that paid the price. What social cost did Jesus go through to buy us back? When he was on the cross, he was being mocked and spit on. He went through physical pain. He went through deep emotional pain, still pursuing us when we've broken his heart. Behold the love of God. Do you see it? Do you see how depraved your sin was? If you never see how depraved and how sick your sin was, you will never appreciate the mercy and the compassion of God to buy you back, even though you spit out his heart, you spit at his heart and broke his heart and did not treat him with respect. Behold the love of God. He's bought you back. If you haven't been bought back yet, the story of Hosea and Gomer should teach us that God will buy anybody back. It does not matter what they've done. God's grace is an infinite ocean for those who want to submit to it, for those who want to learn from it. We're about to sing a song, and I hope that we can consider these things together. If God has been taking things out of your life that meant a lot to you, maybe think about how that might be waking you up. God is trying to woo you back. He'll speak tenderly to you. If anybody needs any encouragement, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.